hear how he has disappointed Carol before she even speaks, and so has put up a wall to keep from catching fire. But the pattern has become so automatic and so compelling that they cannot stop it. Most couples, however, aren't aware of the pattern that has taken hold of their relationship. Angry and frustrated, partners scrabble for explanation. They decide that their lover is callous or cruel. They turn the blame inward on themselves. "Maybe there is something deeply wrong with me," Carol tells me. "It's just like my mom used to say, I'm too difficult to love." They conclude that no one is trustworthy and love is a lie. The idea that these demand-distance spirals are all about attachment panic is still revolutionary to many psychologists and counselors. Most of the colleagues who come to me for training have been taught to see conflict itself and couples' power struggles as the main problems in relationships. As a result, they have focused on teaching couples negotiation and communication skills to contain the conflict. But this addresses the symptoms, not the disease. It's telling people caught in a never-ending dance of frustration and distance to change the steps, when what they have to do is change the music. "Stop telling me what to do," orders Jim. Carol considers this for a nanosecond before angrily retorting, "When I do that, you do nothing and we're nowhere." We can come up with many techniques to address different aspects of couples' distress. But until we understand the core principles that organize love relationships, we cannot really understand love's problems or offer couples enduring help. The demand withdraw pattern is not just a bad habit. It reflects a deeper underlying reality. Such couples are starving emotionally. They're losing the source of their emotional sustenance. They feel deprived, and they are desperate to regain that nurturance. Until we address the fundamental need for connection and the fear of losing it, the standard techniques, such as learning problem-solving or communication skills, examining childhood hurts, or taking timeouts, are misguided and ineffectual. Happy couples do not talk to each other in any more skilled or insightful ways than do unhappy couples, Gottman has shown. They do not always listen empathetically to each other or understand how their pasts might have set up problematic expectations. And in my office, I see very distressed couples who are amazingly articulate and show exquisite insight into their own behavior, but cannot talk to their partners in a coherent way when the emotional tsunami hits. My client, Sally, tells me, "I am pretty good at talking, you know. I have lots of friends. I'm assertive and I'm a good listener. But when we get into these terrible long silences, trying to remember the points from our marriage training weekend is like trying to read a how-to-pull-your-parachute manual when you're in free fall." The standard remedies do not address yearnings for or threats to safe emotional connection. They do not tell couples how to reconnect or how to stay connected. The techniques they're taught may interrupt a fight, but at a terrible cost. They often further the distance between partners, reinforcing fears of being rejected and abandoned just when couples need to reaffirm their bond. Key moments of attachment and detachment. The attachment view of love gives us a way of understanding toxic patterns. It guides us to the moments that break and make a relationship. Clients sometimes tell me, "Things were going so well. We had a great 4 days. It felt like we were friends. But then that one incident happened and everything went to hell between us. I don't understand." Dramatic exchanges between lovers evolve so fast and are so chaotic and heated that we don't catch what's actually happening and can't see how we could react. But if we slow things down, we see the turning points and our options. Attachment needs and the powerful emotions that accompany them often arise suddenly. They catapult the conversation from mundane matters to the issue of security and survival. Johnny is watching too much TV, all at once mushrooms into, I just can't deal with our son's tantrums anymore. I am just a lousy mom. But you're not listening to me right now. I know you have to keep working. That is what is important here, isn't it? Not my feelings. I'm all alone here. If we are feeling basically safe and connected to our partner, this key moment is just like a brief cool breeze on a sunny day. If we're not so sure of our connection, it starts a negative spiral of insecurity that chills the relationship. Bowlby gave us a general guide to when our attachment alarm goes off. It happens, he said, when we feel suddenly uncertain or vulnerable in the world, or when we perceive a negative shift in our sense of connection to a loved one, when we sense a threat or danger to the relationship. The threats we sense can come from the outside world and from our own inner cosmos. They can be true or imaginary. It's our perception that counts, not the reality. Peter, who has been married to Linda for 6 years, has been feeling less important to his lady of late. She has a new job and they make love less often. At a party, a friend comments that while Linda is radiant, Peter seems to be losing his hair. As Peter watches Linda converse attentively with a stunningly handsome man, a man with lots of hair, his stomach churns. Can Peter calm himself with the knowledge that he is precious to his wife and that she will turn to him and be there for him if he asks? Perhaps he remembers a moment when this happened and uses this image to soothe his unease. What happens, though, if he can't quiet his gut? Does he get angry, walk over to his wife, and make a cutting remark to her about flirting? Or does he throw off his concern, tell himself he doesn't care, and go off to have another drink, or six? Either of these ways of dealing with his fear, attacking or retreating, will only alienate Linda. She will feel less connected and less attracted to her mate, and that in turn will only heighten Peter's primal panic. A second key moment occurs after the immediate threat has passed. Partners have the chance to reconnect then, unless their negative coping strategies kick in. At the party later in the evening, Linda seeks Peter out. Does he reach out to her, letting her see the hurt and fear he felt when he saw her talking so intimately with another man? Does he express these emotions in a way that invites her to reassure him? Or does he attack her for whoring around and demand that they immediately go home and make love, or remain silent and withdrawn? A third key moment is when we do manage to tune into our attachment emotions and reach for connection or reassurance, and the loved one responds. Say Peter manages to pull Linda aside, take a deep breath, and tell her that he was having a hard time watching her talk to the handsome stranger. Or maybe he only manages to go and stand beside her and express his upset with a troubled look. Suppose Linda responds positively. Even if he can't quite express his feelings, she senses something is wrong, and she offers Peter her hand. She asks softly if he is okay. She is accessible. She is responsive. But does Peter see this? Does he trust it? Can he take it in, feel comforted, move closer, and continue to confide? Or does he instead stay guarded and push her away so as to avoid feeling so vulnerable? Does he even attack her to test if she really cares? Finally, when Peter and Linda go back to their everyday way of connecting, is he confident that she is there as a safe haven in times of trouble or doubt? Or does he still feel insecure? Does he try to control and push Linda into more and more responses that assure him of her love? Or does he minimize his need for her and instead focus more on distracting tasks and toys? This drama has focused on Peter, but a scenario centered on Linda would reveal she has the same attachment needs and fears. Indeed, men and women alike, we all share these sensitivities, but we may express them a bit differently. When a relationship is in free fall, men typically talk of feeling rejected, inadequate, and a failure. Women, of feeling abandoned and unconnected. Women do appear to have one additional response that emerges when they're distressed. Researchers call it tend and befriend. Perhaps because they have more oxytocin, the cuddle hormone, in their blood, women reach out more to others when they feel a lack of connection. When marriages fail, it is not increasing conflict that is the cause. It is decreasing affection and emotional responsiveness, according to a landmark study by Ted Houston of the University of Texas. Indeed, the lack of emotional responsiveness rather than the level of conflict is the best predictor of how solid a marriage will be 5 years into it. The demise of marriages begins with a growing absence of responsive, intimate interactions. The conflict comes later. As lovers, we poise together delicately on a tightrope. When the winds of doubt and fear begin blowing, if we panic and clutch at each other or abruptly turn away and head for cover, the rope sways more and more, and our balance becomes even more precarious. To stay on the rope, we must shift with each other's moves, respond to each other's emotions. As we connect, we balance each other. We are in emotional equilibrium. Emotional responsiveness, the key to a lifetime of love. A person's heart withers if it does not answer another heart. Pearl S. Buck. Tim and Sarah are sitting in my office. Tim isn't sure why he's here. All he knows, he says, is that he and Sarah have had a brutal fight. She's accused him of ignoring her at a party and is threatening to take their child and move in with her sister. He doesn't understand. They have a good marriage. Sarah is just being too immature and expects too much. She doesn't get how pressured he is at work and that he can't always remember the hearts and flowers part of marriage. Tim turns in his chair and stares out the window with a "what can you do with such a woman" expression on his face. Tim's complaints awaken Sarah from a despairing trance. She announces in an acid tone that Tim is not as smart as he thinks he is. In fact, she tells him, he is a communication cretin who has zero skills. But sadness overwhelms her, and she murmurs in a voice that I can hardly hear that Tim is a stone who turns away when she is dying. She should never have married him. She weeps. How have they arrived at this point? Sarah, a small, dark-haired woman, and Tim, a stylishly groomed man, have been married for 3 years. They have been successful work colleagues and happy play partners, well-matched in skill and energy. They have a new house and an 18-month-old daughter whom Sarah has taken time off from work to care for, and now they are sparring all the time. "All I hear is that I'm home too late and I'm working too hard," Tim says in exasperation. "But I am working for us, you know." Sarah mutters that there is no us. "You say that you don't know me anymore," Tim continues. "Well, this is what grown-up love is all about. It's about making compromises and being buddies." Sarah bites her lip and replies, "You didn't even take time off to be with me when I had the miscarriage. It's all deals and compromises with you." She shakes her head. "I feel so hopeless when I can't get through to you. I have never felt so lonely, not even when I lived alone." Sarah's message is urgent, but Tim doesn't get it. He finds her too emotional. But that is the point. We are never more emotional than when our primary love relationship is threatened. Sarah desperately needs to reconnect with Tim. Tim is desperately afraid that he has lost that intimacy with Sarah. Connection is vital to him as well. But his need for connection is masked by talk of compromise and growing up. He tries to dismiss Sarah's concerns to keep everything calm and on track. Can they begin to emotionally hear each other again? Can they be tuned in once more? How can I help them? The beginning of EFT. My understanding of how to help couples like Sarah and Tim began slowly. I knew that listening to and expanding on key emotions was essential to change with the individuals who came to me for counseling. So when I began to work with distressed couples on hot summer afternoons in Vancouver, Canada in the early 1980s, I recognized the same emotions and how they seemed to create the music for the dance between partners. But my sessions seemed to swing between emotional chaos and silence. Very soon, I was spending every morning in the university library searching for direction, for a map to the dramas that played out in my office. The material that I found mostly said that love was irrelevant or impossible to understand, and also that strong emotions were obviously dangerous and best left alone. Offering insights to couples, as some of these books suggested, insights like how we seem to repeat our parental relationships with our lovers, didn't seem to change much. My attempts to get couples to practice communication skills sparked comments about how these exercises didn't really get to the heart of the matter. They missed the point. I decided that they were right, and that I was somehow missing the point as well. But I was fascinated, so fascinated that I sat and watched hour after hour of videotaped sessions. I decided that I would watch until I really understood these dramas of love gone wrong, maybe even until I understood love. Finally, the picture began to develop. Nothing brings people together like a common enemy, I remembered. I realized that I could help couples by helping them see their negative patterns of interaction, their demon dialogues, as the enemy, not each other. I started recapping couples' exchanges in my sessions, helping partners see the spiral they were caught in, rather than just focusing on the other's last response and reacting to it. If we compare it to tennis, this was like learning to see the whole game, rather than just the serve or the volley on the last ball spinning across the net. Clients began to see the whole dialogue and how it had a life of its own and was hurting them both. But why were these patterns so strong? Why were they so compelling and so distressing? Even when both partners recognized their toxic nature, these dialogues kept repeating. Partners seemed to get pulled back in by their emotions, even when they understood their pattern and how it trapped them both. Why were these emotions so potent? I would sit and watch couples like Jamie and Hugh. The angrier Jamie became, the more she criticized Hugh and the more silent he became. After lots of gentle questions, he told me that underneath his silence, he felt defeated and sad. Sadness tells us to slow down and grieve, so Hugh had begun to grieve his marriage. And of course, the more he closed down, the more Jamie demanded to be let in. Her angry complaint cued his sense of silent defeat, and his silence cued her angry demands. Round and round, they were both stuck. When we slowed down the spin of these circular dances, softer emotions like sadness, fear, embarrassment, and shame always appeared. Talking about these emotions, maybe for the first time, and seeing how their pattern trapped them both, helped Jamie and Hugh feel safer with each other. Jamie didn't look so dangerous when she was able to tell Hugh how alone she felt. No one had to be the bad guy here. They began to have new kinds of conversations, and their narrow exchange of blame and silent distancing slowed down. Sharing their softer emotions, they started to see each other differently. Jamie admitted, "I never saw the whole picture. I just knew he wasn't close to me. I saw him as not caring. Now I see how he was ducking my bullets and trying to calm me down. I shoot when I get desperate and can't get a reaction any other way." Now I was getting somewhere in my practice. Couples were nicer to each other. The drama of painful emotions didn't seem to be so overwhelming. These negative patterns always started when one partner tried to reach for the other and could not make safe emotional contact. That was the moment when the demon dialogue began. Once a couple grasped that they were both victims of the dialogue and were able to show more of themselves to to risk sharing deeper emotions. Then the conflicts calmed down and they felt a little closer. So everything was fine. Or was it? My couples told me no. Jamie told me, "We are nicer to each other and we fight less, but somehow nothing has really changed. If we stop coming here, it will all start up again. I know it will." Others told me the same thing. What was the problem? As I replayed tapes, I saw that deeper emotions like sadness and straight terror, as one client put it, still hadn't really been dealt with. My couples were still watching their backs. Emotion comes from a Latin word, emovere, to move. We talk of being moved by our emotions, and we are moved when those we love show their deeper feelings to us. If partners were to reconnect, they indeed had to let their emotions move them into new ways of responding to each other. My clients had to learn to take risks, to show the softer sides of themselves, the sides they learned to hide in the demon dialogues. I saw that when more withdrawn partners were able to confess their fears of loss and isolation, they could then talk about their longings for caring and connection. This revelation moved their blaming partners into responding more tenderly and sharing their own needs and fears. It was as if both people suddenly stood face to face, naked but strong, and reached for each other. Moments like these were amazing and dramatic. They changed everything and started a new, positive spiral of love and connection. Couples told me that these moments were life-changing. They could not only exit from the demon dialogue, they could move into a new kind of loving responsiveness, of safety and closeness. They could then create a new narrative and plan in an atmosphere of easy cooperation for how to care for their relationship and safeguard their new closeness. But I still didn't understand exactly why these moments were so powerful. I was so riveted by this series of discoveries that I persuaded my thesis advisor, Les Greenberg, that we should do the first study to test this approach and call it Emotionally Focused Therapy, or EFT. We wanted to stress how certain emotional signals changed the connection between lovers. The first study confirmed all my hopes that this way of working with relationships not only helped people step out of negative patterns, it also seemed to create a new sense of loving connection. During the next 15 years, my colleagues and I did more and more studies on EFT, finding that it helped over 85% of the couples who came to us to make significant changes in their relationship. These changes also seemed to last, even in couples who faced terrible stressors, such as a seriously and chronically ill child. We found that EFT worked for truck drivers and lawyers, for gays, for straights, for couples from many different cultures, for couples where women called their men inexpressive and men called their mates angry and impossible. In contrast to other approaches to couple therapy, a couple's level of distress when they came into therapy didn't seem to make much difference in terms of how happy they were at the end. Why? I wanted to find out. But first, there were other puzzles to solve. What was this emotional drama all about? Why were the demon dialogues so common and so powerful? Why did those moments of connection transform relationships? It was as if I had managed to find a way through a strange land, but I still didn't have a map or really understand where I was. I had watched couples move from threatening divorce to falling in love again, and even found out how to encourage and direct this, but the answers to these questions eluded me. Small moments end up defining our lives, for couples in love relationships and for struggling therapists and researchers like me. When I answered a colleague's question, "If love relationships aren't bargains, deals about profit and loss, what are they?" I heard myself say casually, "Oh, they're emotional bonds. You can't reason or bargain for love. It's an emotional response." And suddenly my mind slid into a new place. I went back and looked at my tapes, paying particular attention to the needs and fears people talked about. I looked at those dramatic moments that transformed relationships. I was looking at emotional bonding. Now I understood. I was seeing the emotional responsiveness that John Bowlby said was the basis of loving and being loved. How could I have missed it? It was because I had been taught that this kind of bond ended with childhood. But this was the dance of adult love. I rushed back home to write and bring this insight into my work with couples. Attachment theory answered the three questions that had tormented me. Very simply, it told me that, 1, the powerful emotions that came up in my couples sessions were anything but irrational. They made perfect sense. Partners acted like they were fighting for their lives in therapy because they were doing just that. Isolation and the potential loss of loving connection is coded by the human brain into a primal panic response. This need for safe emotional connection to a few loved ones is wired in by millions of years of evolution. Distressed partners may use different words, but they are always asking the same basic questions. Are you there for me? Do I matter to you? Will you come when I need you, when I call? Love is the best survival mechanism there is, and to feel suddenly emotionally cut off from a partner, disconnected, is terrifying. We have to reconnect, to speak our needs in a way that moves our partner to respond. This longing for emotional connection with those nearest to us is the emotional priority, overshadowing even the drive for food or sex. The drama of love is all about this hunger for safe emotional connection, a survival imperative we experience from the cradle to the grave. Loving connection is the only safety nature ever offers us. 2. These emotions and attachment needs were the plot behind negative interactions like the demon dialogues. Now I understood why this kind of pattern was so compelling and never-ending. When safe connection seems lost, partners go into fight-or-flight mode. They blame and get aggressive to get a response, any response, or they close down and try not to care. Both are terrified. They're just dealing with it differently. Trouble is, once they start this blame-distance loop, it confirms all their fears and adds to their sense of isolation. Emotional edicts as old as time dictate this dance. Rational skills don't change it. Most of the blaming in these dialogues is a desperate attachment cry, a protest against disconnection. It can only be quieted by a lover moving emotionally close to hold and reassure. Nothing else will do. If this reconnection does not occur, the struggle goes on. One partner will frantically try to get an emotional response from the other. The other, hearing that he or she has failed at love, will freeze up. Immobility in the face of danger is a wired-in way to deal with a sense of helplessness. 3. The key moments of change in EFT were moments of secure bonding. In these moments of safe attunement and connection, both partners can hear each other's attachment cry and respond with soothing care, forging a bond that can withstand differences, wounds, and the test of time. These moments shape safe connection, and that changes everything. They provide a reassuring answer to the question, "Are you there for me?" Once partners know how to speak their need and bring each other close, every trial they face together simply makes their love stronger. No wonder these moments create a new dance of trusting connection for couples in EFT. No wonder they make them stronger as individuals. If you know your loved one is there and will come when you call, you're more confident of your worth, your value, and the world is less intimidating when you have another to count on and know that you are not alone. With the first study of EFT, I knew that I had found a path to lead couples from desperate distress to happier connection. But once I understood that all the issues and drama revolved around attachment bonds, I realized that I also had discovered a broad map for love and could systematically plot out the steps of the journey to a special kind of loving connection. Immediately, my sessions with my couples changed. As I watched partners demanding and withdrawing, I saw Bowlby's concepts of separation distress in action. Some partners shouted louder and louder to make the other turn toward them. Others whispered softer and softer so as not to disturb the peace. I heard partners caught in the demon dialogue speak the language of attachment, a desperate need for an emotional response that ends in blaming, and a desperate fear of rejection and loss that ends in withdrawal. This was the scaffolding underneath these endless conflicts. Partners' emotions now were easier to tune into. I understood their urgency. As I reflected my new understanding to my couples, putting their emotions, their needs, their endless conflicts into an attachment frame and directing them toward moments of connection, they told me that this fit for them. They told me they now understood their own unspoken longings and seemingly irrational fears, and could connect with their loved one in a whole new way. They told me what a relief it was to know that there was nothing wrong or immature about these longings and fears. They did not have to hide or deny them. Now we could hone the EFT way of working with couples. We were not just in the right neighborhood. We had a direct map to home base. We could go to the heart of the matter. Over the years, as scientific studies on adult attachment have continued and confirmed what I have learned in leading and watching thousands of couple therapy sessions, the key conversations that promote an emotional bond and a safe, secure connection have become clearer and clearer. We have shown in our studies that when they happen, couples recover from distress and build a stronger bond between them. This book is about sharing these conversations with you in a way that you can use in your own relationship. Until now, this has been a process supervised by professionals trained in EFT. But it is so valuable and so needed that I have simplified the process so that you, the listener, can easily use it to change and grow your relationship. ARE. The basis of EFT is 7 conversations that are aimed at encouraging a special kind of emotional responsiveness that is the key to lasting love for couples. This emotional responsiveness has 3 main components. Accessibility. Can I reach you? This means staying open to your partner even when you have doubts and feel insecure. It often means being willing to struggle to make sense of your emotions so these emotions are not so overwhelming. You can then step back from disconnection and can tune in to your lover's attachment cues. Responsiveness. Can I rely on you to respond to me emotionally? This means tuning in to your partner and showing that his or her emotions, especially attachment needs and fears, have an impact on you. It means accepting and placing a priority on the emotional signals your partner conveys and sending clear signals of comfort and caring when your partner needs them. Sensitive responsiveness always touches us emotionally and calms us on a physical level. Engagement. Do I know you will value me and stay close? The dictionary defines engaged as being absorbed, attracted, pulled, captivated, pledged, involved. Emotional engagement here means the very special kind of attention that we give only to a loved one. We gaze at them longer, touch them more. Partners often talk of this as being emotionally present. One easy way to remember these is to think of the acronym ARE and the phrase, "Are you there? Are you with me?" The 7 conversations of EFT. Let's go back to the story of Sarah and Tim and see how EFT works. We can look at the first 4 conversations that transformed Sarah and Tim's relationship. This will help you understand the changes that Sarah and Tim made and use part 2 of this book to create these changes in your own relationship. Like Sarah and Tim, you can learn to stop the slide into emotional starvation and distance that plagues so many relationships. But more than that, you can learn the exquisite logic of love and the conversations that build it. In the first conversation, recognizing the demon dialogues, I encourage the couple to identify the damaging dance they get into, when this dance happens, and how each partner's moves escalate their confrontations. Once they are aware of their negative steps, I ask them to dig beneath the destructive remarks and to figure out what they're really saying. Sarah's attacks and demands are a desperate protest against the erosion of her bond with Tim, while Tim's defensiveness and cool rationality are expressions of his fears that Sarah is disappointed in him and that he is losing her. The more he tries to dismiss her concerns, the more alone she feels, and the angrier she becomes. After a while, all they have left is accusations and defensiveness. But now Tim and Sarah can have a new, positive conversation, one that gives them power over this protest polka demon dialogue. Sarah is able to say, "I guess I do come on heavy. I do get hostile. I feel so let down, so I confront you to get you to see it, to see what's happening and come back to me. But it just drives you away and into justifying yourself, and I guess I seem pretty dangerous to be around then, so you retreat even more. Then I get even more upset. We are stuck. I never saw that before." Tim is able to see how his distancing sets Sarah up to become more demanding. They begin to see the pattern and to stop blaming the other for the steps. Now they're ready for a second conversation. In finding the raw spots, Tim and Sarah begin to understand their own and their partner's reactions, and that the drama here is all about the safety of their emotional attachment. Each partner starts to look beyond immediate reactions, such as Sarah's rage and Tim's cool distancing. We begin to plug into the deeper current of softer feelings, feelings connected with attachment needs and fears. Tim turns to a calmer and very attentive Sarah and says, "You're right. Last night at that moment, I could not hear your hurt. All I see is your anger at times like that. All I hear is that I have blown it again, failed again. I just never can get it right." He brings his hands up to cover his face. He sighs and continues, "So, I guess I just try to put a lid on everything, to stop the fight and the examples of how I have blown it yet again. But do you think I don't know that I'm losing you?" He hangs his head. Sarah leans forward and puts her hand gently on his arm. It's not that he does not care for or need her. It is that he cannot deal with the fear of losing her. Sarah and Tim begin to realize that no one can dance with a partner and not touch each other's raw spots. We must know what these raw spots are and be able to speak about them in a way that pulls our partner closer to us. Sarah and Tim now know the danger cues and sensitivities to certain events that spark off attachment fears. "I do get enraged when you're late," Sarah tells Tim. "It reminds me of my dad. After he left us, he would always call and say he loved me and tell me when he was coming to pick me up, and then he'd never show. I'd hope, and then get that I was a fool to think I was important to him. This feels the same." Talking to Tim of her disappointment and longing rather than her anger at him gives Tim a new view of Sarah and what is at stake for her here. He listens more, and they begin connecting on a deeper emotional level. In a third conversation, revisiting a rocky moment, this couple replay a time when they got stuck in a demand-distance loop, acknowledging the steps each made and the emotions each felt. They now are in control of the momentum created by their dance. What does this look like? Sarah: "We got so caught up in it, that polka thing. Before I knew it, I heard myself threatening to leave. But this time, part of my head was saying, 'What am I doing? What are we doing? We are stuck in this again.' I understand now that this need to get him to respond is just part of loving someone. I don't have to feel bad about it, but I get hot just talking about it. I was getting scared. He sounded like he was reneging on his promise that we would go away for that weekend together, and I just lost it. Then I realized, wait a minute, here we are again. Let's slow down here. By that time, he had left the room. She turns to Tim. So I came and found you and said to you, hey, we're caught in that polka thing. I'm feeling let down like you aren't going to keep your promise. She beams. Tim. You're right. I had already shut down, given up. But somewhere in the back of my mind, I remembered our talks. So when you came and found me, I was relieved. Then I could tell you that I did want to go on the weekend with you. We seemed to be able to step out of that dance and kind of grab hold of each other, calm each other down. It helped that I remembered you saying that you were scared that I would let you down and not take the time off for the trip. I didn't just hear you angrily telling me what a big disappointment I am. Sarah, I never understood that it impacted you so much when I got angry. In fact, I thought it didn't get to you at all. So yes, I would get desperate, frantic, in fact. I couldn't get you to respond to me. It didn't help when you and your family would give me the message that I should just grow up and handle things on my own. I would feel even more alone then. Tim reaches for her. I know. I didn't understand. We would just get caught in this thing, you hurting and lonely and me feeling like some kind of idiot. I couldn't figure out what was wrong with us, and the more I avoided and played it down, the worse it got. Sue says this happens a lot. Guess we never have talked that much about our emotional needs, what we need from each other. Sarah, this dance we get stuck in is the problem. Even though you are a space cadet sometimes as far as being close is concerned. She smiles. He tips his head to acknowledge her point and smiles back. Tim and Sarah can now do what securely attached couples can do. They can recognize and accept each other's attachment protests. They have a safe place to stand to begin a new conversation to deepen their emotional bond. These first three conversations de-escalate tension in the relationship and prepare the couple for the next dialogues, which build and strengthen the bond. The fourth conversation, Hold Me Tight, is the one that transforms relationships. This is the exchange that moves partners into being more accessible, emotionally responsive, and deeply engaged with each other. The final three conversations, Forgiving Injuries, Bonding Through Sex and Touch, and Keeping Your Love Alive, all rest on the foundation of the intimate connection created in this dialogue. Once couples know how to have the fourth conversation, they have a remedy to the ups and downs of love and a way out of the snares of disconnection. Hold Me Tight is a difficult but intoxicating conversation. The emotional bond forged here is something that many couples have never experienced, even in the midst of initial infatuation when their bodies were flooded with passion's hormones. It is similar to the joyous connection between parent and child, except that it is more complex, reciprocal, and sexual. As this conversation unfolds, partners see themselves and their lovers differently. They find themselves feeling new emotions and responding in new ways. They can now take more risks and reach for more intimacy. Let's look at how this conversation goes for a couple like Tim and Sarah when everything clicks into place. Tim can now tell his wife that he gets crazy paralyzed when he feels unable to please her. He ends up shutting down, but he doesn't want to do this anymore. Now he adds, "But I don't know how to be close. I'm not sure I even know what it looks like. I can't do it, except to see if Sarah wants to have sex." But attachment responses are wired in, and when I ask Tim how he shows his little daughter how much he loves her, his face lights up. "Oh, I whisper to her and hold her, especially at night before bed, he offers. And as she smiles at me when I come home, I have little phrases to let her know I'm glad to see her. She likes when I kiss her cheek and tell her that she's my sweetie forever. And I play with her, give her my undivided attention just for those special moments. Then his eyes go wide. He knows what I'm going to say. Oh, so when you feel safe, you're pretty good at love and closeness. In fact, you know how to tune in to your loved ones. You know how to respond tenderly and how to connect. Tim smiles, unsure but hopeful. We then talk about what blocks him from being this responsive and tender with his spouse. He turns to Sarah and tells her that often he is too on edge, too afraid to play and tune in to her. This is a defining moment in Tim and Sarah's relationship. He stops briefly, then continues. "I know I've neglected you," he confesses. "I know I have let you down. I get so caught up in proving myself at work and to you. Then when I hear you're angry in spite of all my efforts, it kills me. I can't take it, so I shut down. But I want us to be together. I need you. I want you to give me a chance here, to stop watching for the slip-up and to hear that you're very important to me. I want us to be together. I don't always know how to do it." Sarah's eyes go wide and her brow furrows as she weeps. Tim has become accessible. He can tell his wife about his attachment needs and vulnerabilities. He is emotionally engaged. It is this that matters, not exactly what he says. But Sarah at first does not know how to handle this stranger. Can she trust him? In just a short time, he has changed the music in the relationship from a polka to a tango, a dance of intense connection. So she lapses back into a testing, hostile comment. "And when you don't know, as you put it, you will dash off to work where you are the expert, no?" Gradually, as Tim continues to express his needs, Sarah sees the man I fell in love with, the man I always wanted. It is then Sarah's turn to move into a new dance where she can soften her angry stance. She can tell him about her fear that he had abandoned her and her longing for his reassurance. I encourage her to ask specifically for what she needs to make her feel safe. "It's such a risk, like leaping from a great height in the hope you will catch me," she says hesitantly. "I have built up so much distrust."
"Ask me," he whispers. "I am here."
She replies, "I need your reassurance. I need your attention, to know that I come first, even if just for moments. I need you to see and to respond if I hurt, if I'm scared. Can you hold me?" He stands and pulls her up into an embrace. I know from watching thousands of couples that these are the key moments that move relationships from shaky to solid ground, that help couples find a lifetime of love. In these moments, Tim and Sarah create that trust, that secure connection we all long for. Play and practice. The following questionnaire and exercises will help you begin to see your relationship through the attachment lens. The ARE questionnaire. This questionnaire is a great way to begin applying the wisdom in this book to your own relationship. Simply listen to each statement and write down true or false for your answer. To score the questionnaire, give 1 point for each true answer. You can complete this questionnaire and reflect on your relationship on your own, or you and your partner can each complete it and then discuss your answers together in the way described after the questionnaire. Again, answer each question, true or false. From your viewpoint, is your partner accessible to you? 1. I can get my partner's attention easily. 2. My partner is easy to connect with emotionally. 3. My partner shows me that I come first with him, her. 4. I am not feeling lonely or shut out in this relationship. 5. I can share my deepest feelings with my partner. He, she will listen. From your viewpoint, is your partner responsive to you? 1. If I need connection and comfort, he, she will be there for me. 2. My partner responds to signals that I need him, her to come close. 3. I find I can lean on my partner when I am anxious or unsure. 4. Even when we fight or disagree, I know that I am important to my partner and we will find a way to come together. 5. If I need reassurance about how important I am to my partner, I can get it. Are you positively emotionally engaged with each other? 1. I feel very comfortable being close to, trusting my partner. 2. I can confide in my partner about almost anything. 3. I feel confident even when we are apart that we are connected to each other. 4. I know that my partner cares about my joys, hurts, and fears. 5. I feel safe enough to take emotional risks with my partner. With 1 point for each true answer, if you have scored 7 or above, you're well on your way to a secure bond and can use this book to enhance that bond. If you score below 7, this is a time to focus on using the conversations in this book to strengthen the bond with your lover. Understanding the bond between you and your partner and sharing how you see it is the first step to being able to create the connection you both want and need. Does your partner's perception of how accessible, responsive, and engaged you are fit with your view of yourself and how safe your relationship is? Try to remember that your partner is talking about how safe and connected he or she feels right now in your relationship, not about whether you are a perfect or imperfect partner. You can take turns talking about the question or answer that seemed most positive and important for you. It is best to keep this to 5 minutes each. Now, if you feel comfortable, try to explore the question or answer that seemed to bring up the most difficult emotions for you. Try to do this in the spirit of helping your partner tune in to your feelings. He or she will not be able to do this if you get caught up in being negative, so try to avoid criticism or blame. Again, it is best to keep this talk to 5 minutes each. Exploring your emotional connections. Maybe you're more comfortable reflecting on general points rather than using the questionnaire. You can simply reflect on the following questions, or you might want to write your answers down in a journal and so deepen your exploration of them. You might also want to share and discuss your responses with your partner at some point. Did the story of Tim and Sarah make sense to you? Did it seem familiar? What part really seemed important to you, and how do you understand that? What messages about love and marriage did you get from your parents, your community? Was being able to reach for and trust others seen as a strength and a resource? Before your present relationship, did you experience a safe, loving relationship with someone you trusted, felt close to, and could turn to if needed? Do you have an image of what this looks like in your head, a model that can help you as you create your present relationship? Think of one good time or typical moment that captures this relationship and share it with your partner. Did your past relationships teach you that loved ones were unreliable and that you had to be vigilant and fight to be seen and responded to? Or did you learn that depending on others is dangerous and it is best to distance yourself, to not need others and avoid closeness? These basic strategies often switch on when we feel that our lover is distant or disconnected. Which strategy did you use in past relationships, say with your parents, when things started to go wrong? Can you remember a time when you really needed to know a loved one was with you? If he or she was not, what was that like for you, and what did you learn from it? How did you cope? Does this have an impact on your relationships now? If it is hard for you to turn to and trust others, to let them close when you really need them, what do you do when life gets too big to handle or when you feel alone? Name two very concrete and specific things that a safe, accessible, responsive, and engaged lover in a relationship with you would do on a typical day, and how those things would make you feel at that moment. In your present relationship, can you ask your partner, let him or her see, when you need closeness and comfort? Is this easy for you or difficult to do? Perhaps you wonder if this is a sign of weakness, or maybe it seems too risky for you. Rate your difficulty in doing this on a scale from 1 to 10. A high score means this is very difficult for you to do. Share this with your partner. When you feel disconnected or alone in your present relationship, are you likely to get very emotional or even anxious and push your partner to respond? Or are you more likely to shut down and try not to feel your need to connect? Can you think of a time when this happened? Think of a time in your relationship when questions like, "Are you there for me?" were hanging in the air unanswered, and you wound up getting into a fight about a mundane problem. Share this with your partner. Can you think of bonding moments in your relationship when one of you reaches out and the other responds in a way that makes you both feel emotionally connected and secure with each other? Share this with your partner. Now that you have a sense of what love and the creation of positive dependency is all about, the transforming conversations in the following chapters will show you how to create this kind of bond with your partner. The first four conversations teach you how to limit negative spirals that leave you both disconnected and how to tune into each other in a way that builds lasting emotional responsiveness. The next two conversations demonstrate how you can promote emotional bonding through forgiving injuries and sexual intimacy. The final conversation shows you how to care for your relationship on a daily basis. Part 2. 7 Transforming Conversations. Conversation 1. Recognizing the Demon Dialogues. Strife is better than loneliness. Irish proverb. For all of us, the person we love most in the world, the one who can send us soaring joyfully into space, is also the person who can send us crashing back to earth. All it takes is a slight turning away of the head or a flip, careless remark. There is no closeness without this sensitivity. If our connection with our mate is safe and strong, we can deal with these moments of sensitivity. Indeed, we can use them to bring our partner even closer. But when we don't feel safe and connected, these moments are like a spark in a tinder forest. They set fire to the whole relationship. This is what has happened in the first 3 minutes of an explosive session with Jim and Pam, a long married couple who were experiencing a serious downswing in their relationship, though they still noted each other's appealing qualities. Jim had told me several times in previous sessions that Pam's golden hair and blue eyes entranced him, and Pam often observed that he was a good husband and father, and even a little bit handsome himself. The session starts innocently enough, with Pam saying she and Jim had a pleasant week together, and that she had decided to try to comfort Jim more whenever she saw that he was feeling stressed by his work. She also says that she would really like him to be able to tell her when he needed emotional support. Jim snorts, rolls his eyes, and swivels his chair away from his wife. At that moment, I swear I could feel a hot wind rush through my office. Pam blasts, "What the hell do you mean by that? That ridiculous expression? I have tried a lot harder to be supportive in this relationship than you have, you smug son of a bitch. Here I am offering to support you."